This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. For over 35 years, artist William Christenberry has been working on a piece called The Klan Room on the iconography of racism. The room is given over to nearly 400 objects, including hundreds of dolls menacingly dressed in the hooded disguises of the Klan. The Klan Room is just one manifestation of Christenberry's obsession with the rural South. He was born in Hale County, Alabama during the Depression. Many of his sculptures are miniatures of abandoned shacks and boarded-up general stores and diners. A retrospective of his work called Reconstruction is now on exhibit at the Museum of American Art in Philadelphia. The show includes his Klan Room. He told me about the dolls he's dressed in hooded robes.
I guess, for me, when I conceived the idea of a doll, in this case, or originally, it was a Barbie doll dressed as a Klansperson. But the Barbie did not flex or bend at the joints. And in 1964, G.I. Joe made his appearance on the scene. And I'll never forget going to a Zayer department store in Memphis, where I was living at the time, and I bought 20 G.I. Joe dolls one night. But it began to really mushroom then with the three-dimensional objects. The three-dimensional objects then being put into buildings, architectural forms that oftentimes replicated the hooded head and sort of a pointed top building. And recently I was able to or asked to be a part of a wonderful place in Philadelphia called the Fabric Workshop, where they can do anything you've ever dreamed of with fabric. And we made there, or I began there, a number of dolls that are much tougher, meaner, uglier, where I appear to have sort of punished them by pouring wax on them, binding them up, sticking pins in them, and the like. But it's meant to be a composite or a tableau. I don't think it can be photographed adequately, or I don't think you can sense what it's about unless you walk into the space.
Well, it's funny you say that, because when you walk into the space, you definitely feel like you're in the space of another orbit. I mean, there's just, first of all, in the exhibit that I saw, the light is kind of dimmed and maybe has a slight reddish tinge to it, though that might be my imagination or the effect of the works in there. But you're out of your element when you're in there. You're surrounded by this presence of Klan iconography.
I hope so. That's the intention, is to create a feeling. There have been a very strong feeling, hopefully, of revulsion or repulsion. The lighting, you're correct. We spent a lot of time wherever this is exhibited with the lighting, a lot of red light or red gel over white lights, a few spotlights, white lights, but trying to create an environment, a feeling.
What was the presence of the Klan in your life when you were growing up in Alabama? How open were they where you were? Did you ever knowingly see Klan's people?
Well, in the late 50s, you would hear rumors of Klan meetings, but usually they were secret meetings, maybe way out in the country or in the attic or loft of an old building, an old warehouse. But it was in 1960 in my hometown of Tuscaloosa, Alabama, where I first encountered the Klan at the Tuscaloosa County Courthouse. And it was enough to frighten me. I still have almost nightmares about that meeting. Or I didn't see but one Klansman. But out of that encounter came a lot of work. And that stimulated or helped stimulated this need on my part to, as I've said many times, come to grips with that aspect of evil that we call the Ku Klux Klan.
So what were you doing there? They were holding a meeting and you were curious?
I'll tell the story. I read in the Tuscaloosa News. I left Alabama in 61 and went to New York for a while. But in 1960, I was still there teaching at the university, teaching drawing and painting. And I read in the Tuscaloosa newspaper that there would be, on the front page, down the left-hand bottom of the page, that there would be a Klan rally down at the county courthouse. So I said to a friend, I said, why don't we go down there and see what it's like? I was curious. And we got down there that evening, and there was no evidence of any Klan activity. The street lights were on. There were cars out front. I didn't see many people, and I certainly didn't see any people dressed as Klansmen. And I said to my friend, let's go inside. Let's go look inside. He said, no, you go. Obviously, he was a little fearful, and he was Jewish, and I think he thought twice about going in there. So I started up these old marble stairs, second level, nothing. Third level, just as I got to the top of the steps, to my left, standing as a sentinel, was a Klansman in full robe and hood. And he didn't turn his body to look at me. He didn't even turn his head. He just turned his eyes to the right and looked at me through those eye hole slits. And I just ran back down the steps. And that was my first encounter ever with a Klansman. But by the 60s, certainly by the mid-60s, the Klan was being forced out of cover, so to speak, trying to improve their image, if that's possible. And we could go to open meetings. I attended two meetings in Memphis in the summer of 66 and one in outside of Tuscaloosa in 1966. And the one in Tuscaloosa or outside Tuscaloosa was, how shall I say, full blast theater. It was an amazing experience.
Well, share some of the images from that really made an impression on you that you've been trying to recapture in your art since then.
Well, I think always it's been that hooded head form. I've been for a long time and continue to be very much interested in the mask, any kind of mask throughout mankind's history. And this hooded head that the Klan uses, this hood that where the apex of the triangle is at the top, which sort of reverses the structure of our head. In other words, we can imagine our head, the human head, having a triangular form of sorts, the apex of the triangle being our chin. By reversing what we think of, what we know as our head, they have made this thing somewhat, well, I think unbelievably frightening.
Have you ever held a real Klan robe in your hands?
Yes, I have one that was given me by a collector of political memorabilia, and it probably dates, it's his guess, from the 20s. For some reason, he believes it came from West Virginia. It's a pretty frightening thing, especially the hood, because all around the eye holes is hand-stitched, and it's muslin. It's not satin like the contemporary Klan. It's a frightening object.
There's a little booklet in your current exhibit, a booklet for responses from gallery goers. And the booklet says, some people have told me that this subject is not the proper concern of an artist or art. On the contrary, I hold the position that there are times when an artist must examine and reveal such strange and secret brutality. What are the negative reactions that you're referring to there?
I've not often had anyone say to my face that I shouldn't be dealing with this subject matter, but it's come back to me often, even from from intelligent, sensitive people who believe that art should not or artists shouldn't be involved with such things. One of the several artists that I admire so much in terms of dealing with the, how shall I say, the reality of their times were Goya and then Picasso with Guernica. In our time, there's a very strong German artist named Anselm Kiefer, who was born the year World War II ended, 1945, and he's been trying through his work to come to grips with his country's Nazi past. So it's hurtful when I'm told this or I get word of this. But very few people have said that directly to me. There have been reactions in exhibitions where someone that I didn't know would argue that this should be dealt with or not. But most of the time, it's been in a roundabout way.
You live and teach in Washington, D.C., and in 1979, your studio was broken into, and a lot of the Klan work was stolen. From what I understand, the thieves were never found, but you suspect it was the work of the Klan. Why do you suspect that?
No, I do not.
You don't suspect that?
That was my first fear. That was my first and greatest fear when it happened. Because the theft was devastating, not just in terms of the loss, but the effect it had on my wife and then small children, the nature of the theft, the obsessiveness of it, the door was locked back up, there was no vandalism. I could better have understood the theft if I had found the room vandalized and things broken or strewn about. And therefore, initially, you couldn't help but think, could it have been the Klan? But I don't think so now. I think it's somebody that probably just wanted, in the wrong sense, the negative sense of the word, possess the work. And that's frightening, too. But no, I don't. I think the Klan would really like for me to have known that they took it, because they have a tendency to leave calling cards and the like.
My guest is artist William Christenberry. A retrospective of his work is now on exhibit at the Museum of American Art in Philadelphia. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with artist William Christenberry, his work evokes the rural South of his childhood. The Ku Klux Klan work is just one part of your work. There's a lot of your work that's really tied up with, in a way, a South that no longer exists. Abandoned country stores, abandoned diners, abandoned shacks, small wooden churches that are closed up. Why does this architecture of the past capture your imagination?
Well, I want to say right up front that it's not nostalgia for the past. I have very strong, mostly positive feelings about where I'm from and a deep affection for where I'm from. The way I was brought up in a very closely knit family, the storytelling tradition that I grew up with. But I tend to gravitate towards the things you mentioned because I don't know if I achieved this, but I see a kind of poetry or poignancy in these things that are disappearing. The South is changing rapidly. It's becoming a more affluent part of this country, and it's unfortunately, too, it's beginning, that's not unfortunate, but it's unfortunate that it's beginning to look like almost everywhere else. And these things that I've photographed, that I've made sculptures of, that I've drawn and painted are not going to be around much longer.
Now, was this architecture being used when you were growing up? Were the diners actually?
Oh, yes.
Uh-huh.
Yes, and the churches, the country churches, the Christenberry Family Church, the church my father attended as a child, still stands. It was built towards the end of the Civil War, Providence Methodist Church. But it's truly, as the hymn says, the church in the wildwood. It's so far back out in the country now and hasn't been functioning in any capacity for the last 30 years or more.
What does it look like now?
Distant cousins, bought the church and a few acres of land around it, and he's done a pretty good job of being certain that the roof doesn't have a hole in it, and sort of maintained it, thank goodness. So it hasn't changed that much. It's just way, way back out in the country, but a beautiful structure. And I, for some reason, I can't explain this, had this fascination with this kind of pyramidal form, this triangle that keeps coming back in a positive way and a negative way.
You're positive in the architecture, negative in the hoods of the Klan.
Yes, exactly. I remember in drawing class many years ago in the early 50s at the University of Alabama, my instructors would point that out about this pyramidal form. Now, at that time, I was not involved with any expression regarding the Klan, nor was I involved with drawing or painting the vernacular architecture at that time. It came later.
You're just joining us. My guest is artist William Christenberry. And it's interesting, the county that you grew up in Alabama, Hale County, is the county that Let Us Now Praise Famous Men was inspired by. It's the county that Walker Evans documented in photographs and James A.G. wrote about. And this is a very influential, now famous book about Southern poverty. And you discovered this book when I guess you were a young man.
In 1960, to be exact, when the second printing, the first printing of 1941 was remaindered, so I didn't discover it until the second printing came out in 1960.
Now, over the years, you've taken photos of some of the same buildings that Walker Evans photographed and some of the same places that he photographed. But the interesting thing is he seemed so interested in capturing literally the faces of poor people, mm-hmm. capturing their faces, their bodies. Who are they? Who are these people? There are very few people in... I can't really think of any people, actually, in the photos and sculptures of yours that I've seen. You're really interested in the buildings and the exteriors of the buildings and the advertising on and around the buildings.
Also, I'm interested in how shall I say, mankind's touch or mankind's effect on these things,
mm-hmm.
more than I am in the people. I'd be very truthful with you. I've never had any real desire to photograph people. I don't know why that is. I sometimes say this rather jokingly. Maybe it's because I feel uncomfortable being photographed myself, but that's not a good excuse. But I do tend to look at the effect of what people have done to the landscape or to a structure, and certainly what time and the elements have, how that they have affected these things.
Oh, absolutely, yeah, and a lot of the exteriors of the buildings that influence and inspire you are really weathered, and there's advertising signs that have peeled off,
yes.
or sheet metal advertising signs that have rusted and the paint is dulled. I'm interested in your interest in signs and in advertising. And a lot of the ads, you know, are for archaic, for archaic products like Grape-It soda and snuff, which I don't know if people use anymore. 31 cents a gallon gasoline.
Right. Well, 31 cent gas. That picture was made in 1964, and you do see through my work or in my work a good bit of evidence of the passing of time and how things have changed. But I've always loved old signage, especially signage, as you said, it has weathered and been affected by things. It's what I call the aesthetics of the aging process.
Mm.
And I have quite a wonderful gathering. I don't really like the word collection of these signs that I've begged, borrowed, and sometimes stolen. Not stolen, really, but you'd say to an owner of an old country store. This is back in the 60s and 70s when these things were very prevalent. I really like that old Coca-Cola sign out there, and would you take 50 cents for it? And he usually would say, you'd really like that thing? If you see any more, just take them. They were glad to get rid of them. And now that's a vanishing aspect of outdoor advertising. It's changed dramatically. And would you believe these objects now have monetary value, even in the condition that they're in, that I like so much.
Well, one wall in your current museum show is totally taken up with 6 sheet metal ads for Royal Crown Soda.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to say, I thought they were just really beautiful.
Well, when you see them in that context, not just in a museum context, but put on a wall like that, here we have one to the left would be in pretty good condition. Then by the time you get to number 6, it's essentially the same sign, but through that stage, those stages, has now total rust. And I just thought I still think that's a beautiful thing. So we grouped them, or I grouped them like that, kind of to show the passing of time and how things are affected by nature and whatever.
You went to New York in the early 60s to see art, to study art. And that coincided with the early days of pop art. I'm wondering what influence pop art had on you.
Well, that's a good question. Sure, I was in New York 61, 62, which was a pivotal time in American art because it was a transition time between abstract expressionism and the coming of pop art. I was so heavily into abstract expressionism as a student. And even at the time I moved there, de Kooning and Pollock and Franz Klein, artists like that. But the effect of pop was more, I never felt a direct influence. Obviously, it's there. It was more the expressionistic tendencies and also what we call neo-dada, neo-Dadaism.
Until you saw pop art, did you think that these weathered signs and abandoned buildings could be the subject of art?
I can't deny that it probably influenced me or affected me. I just never felt a real influence from, say, some of the pop artists that we readily know, like Warhol.
Mm-hmm.
Although I have to tell you, I did make a piece in 1975, and I think that's the exact year that he made our group 32 paintings of Campbell's Soup Can. I found, between 71 and 75, 32 Top Snuff signs in various and sundry places in the countryside, and I grouped those in kind of a tongue-in-cheek reference to his hand-painted Campbell's Soup Can. So there's certainly a relationship like that. But it was more the influence, I feel, of de Kooning early on, and then after that, artist that I discovered, not in New York, but after I went to Memphis, Jasper Johns and Robert Rauschenberg. And they were fellow Southerners. They were at least born in the South, so I had this attraction or this thing in common.
William Christenberry, his retrospective is at the Museum of American Art at the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts in Philadelphia. He'll be back with us in the second part of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with artist William Christenberry. A retrospective of his work is now on exhibit at the Museum of American Art in Philadelphia. Many of his sculptures and paintings evoke the disappearing rural South that he grew up in. One of the pieces is literally from his childhood. One of the walls in the current museum show in Philadelphia is given over to the pages of a calendar that your grandfather had. And this also, just as a found object, it's beautiful. And the calendar was published by a company specializing in laxatives.
Mm-hmm.
And so some of the ads, one of the ads reads, "Let's shake on this. When you are in need of a good laxative that is economical, too, Black Draft is the friendly, favored choice, popular with four generations." Did you remember this calendar on your grandfather's wall?
I do. My grandfather, Christenberry, was bedridden the last several years of his life with asthma and a heart condition. But he kept that beside his bed and that calendar, and periodically he would take it down and with pencil write in important dates in the family's history. The earliest date I've found is 1866. He writes Mammy Duncan's birthday. That would have been his wife's mother's birthday. So this was in our family after his death, and as you can see in the exhibition, it's very fragile. It's on old newsprint. The calendar dates 1947. And in 1973, one of my father's older sisters had this, and I knew that, and I asked her. We called her Aunt Sister. I always thought that was a good name. I said, "Aunt Sister, I would like to be considered to have this eventually. Could it possibly be handed down to me?" And she said, "I think you should have it." And I immediately framed it archivally because I knew it would not hold up if it were not protected. And in that same year, I had the idea, why not sort of pay homage to him, to D.K. Christenberry? And I put up the 12 months framed, a walking stick that he had carved, and a receipt for taxes paid in the year 1949 for $29 and some few cents. So it's called Calendar Wall for D.K. Christenberry, and it's a very valuable thing to me because it's a fascinating record of the history of the family, both the tragic and the comic. He had a sense of humor. He also must have been a rather sensitive man because he would sometimes record the first dove coo of the spring or the first whippoorwill call, or when he bought his first pickup truck. It's a wonderful history, and I value it very much.
I, not knowing your family, I like it as just being evocative of a time, of a place, and also of an advertising style.
Mm-hmm. Yes. you can look at Calendar Wall on two levels. From a distance, it, to me, aesthetically, is beautiful. The aging of the newspaper.
Yes,
That chrome yellow. Mm-hmm. Ink, the red ink, sort of the scarlet red ink, and the black ink, of course, and then you get up close to it and begin to read it, to participate with at a different level with it. So I think it works. I don't show it too often because I don't exhibit it too often because it's sensitive to light now. But certainly in this retrospective, I felt the need to have it there.
You have a series of works called Dream Buildings that are little miniature buildings that you've designed that have come to you in dreams. At least I know the first one did. Mm-hmm. And the first one is just particularly eerie. It has that kind of pyramid top, that shape that you've described as a shape that has obsessed you for many years. Mm-hmm. And there's no windows, so it's kind of like the building is masked. You've said you're interested in masks. It's almost as if the building's wearing one because there's no windows there. And it's totally covered over by, or a lot of it's covered over by old signs and things like that. Buildings don't come to me in dreams. I don't dream about buildings. So well, I'm wondering what it was like to have a, you know, dream about a building and what the message of this building was in your dream.
Well, I think every artist, certainly visual artist, would like to be able to tap the source of the dream more often, but I can't. It just, when it happens, it happens. And this was 1979, just 2 weeks after the theft of the Klan work that we mentioned earlier. And I was, one night I dreamed that I was on a backcountry road, and I'm in Washington when I have the dream now. And I dreamed that I'm on a backcountry road, and I came around a curve in that road, and here before me was a building with no windows and no doors, with an unbelievably pitched roof, and it was covered with these outdoor advertising signs that I love so much. And I got up the next morning, and the dream was as clear as a bell, and I decided I was going to make that building. And since 79, that first one that you mentioned, I have now made 23 dream buildings, all variations on that original dream. And I was not conscious until several weeks into making that first one that really what I was doing was replicating the hooded head. I think it shows the intensity of that theft, and that it certainly was within me a lot.
This is the theft of many of your Klan works.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
I know when you were a child you lost one eye in an accident, which means that all these years you've been an artist, you've been working without depth perception. How do you think it's affected your art, only seeing two dimensions?
Well, only in recent years, because of publications and the like, has this word gotten around that I only use one eye. The eye that was injured in a freak accident when I was 14, I have no lens, but what I see is like late, late, late Monet. It's beautiful. It's like a camera being totally without focus, but a lot of light and the most exquisite colors. But I don't use that eye. I can't use that eye. But people that now know the story or know that I only see out of one eye ask me that question. How has it affected your work? I have no idea. I really don't. I have no way of knowing that.
So if you see all these colors and blurs in that eye, mm-hmm. Do you keep that eye covered a lot of the time?
No, uh-uh. Mm-mm.
Well, it must be pretty distracting, though.
It can be, because really when I'm looking at something, I'm seeing two of those things. I'm seeing the good one, the perfect one with my good eye, and I'm seeing a blurred, ghost-like form of the other if I concentrate on that. If I don't concentrate, your mind blocks it out. It blocks it out. Now, focusing a camera, and since 1970, you know, I started out using a little Brownie camera. That's how I started making these things. And the original Brownie pictures, color pictures, they were always color, really, were references back in the studio for those big expressionistic paintings of the time. But in 1977, I began to use an 8x10 camera where you really have to focus under a dark cloth. And that still, as long as my left eye is in good condition, it hasn't posed a tremendous problem.
A lot of your work is about the passage of time. And you're in your 60s now, and in that sense, time is passing in your life as well. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if you see the past differently as you get older, if the meaning of the past or the pull of the past changes for you.
I think it becomes more intense. I was 60 this past November, and as I get older, now realizing more and more, not dwelling on it, but realizing more and more my own mortality, all of these things become more intense. and unwavering in my desire to, as I said at the beginning, come to grips with every aspect of what I'm trying to do. But this passing of time element, oh, it's only been 12 or 15 years ago that I really began to look at in my work or through my work the fact that what I've been doing is, in essence, sort of recording in a way, in one way or another, the passing of time. So now, being 1997, I will go back to the places that I photographed, if they still exist, in from 1967 or 77 or 87. You never know. Many of those things that I've dealt with are gone and are going rapidly as the place changes so much. But it is still something that I most desire to do, and not so much show the passing of time, but to deal with the things that I know and care so much about.
So are you going back to the South this summer?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. In August we'll be going. We don't know the exact date, but I can't pass that up. We've lived in Washington since 1968, and we're close to 30 years of making that trek, first with small babies, and now as the children get older, they don't go as often with us. But I will always go back.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
William Christenberry's retrospective, Reconstruction, will be at the Museum of American Art of the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts in Philadelphia through August 31st. Tomorrow, we'll talk about a new history exhibit exploring the South during Reconstruction, the period just after the end of slavery and the Civil War.